This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
It's the evening edition. I'm Tasha Fusil. Last week, we caught up with big data expert Andreas Weigen, the former and only chief scientist at Amazon.com. He's also the author of a book called Data for the People, How to Make Our Post-Privacy Economy Work for You. Uma Pagana Bikke Pagan sat down with Andreas to find out more about the inner workings of a tech behemoth like Amazon and to hear his philosophies on data privacy and how to embrace and live in a world where data is everything.
Andreas, we're going to be having a conversation about data and the future. But before we get into that, in a previous life, of course, you were a former chief scientist at Amazon.com.
I was the one and only chief scientist.
The one and
Amazon
only chief
had.
Scientist. And tell me, what does the chief scientist do at Amazon.com?
Like any scientist, experiments. So we came up with hypotheses about how people make decisions. And then, rather than just going by whoever makes more is right, we ran experiments. We tried to figure out, what do people do? And it's amazing that not only has the way how we observe people making decisions changed, but actually people make decisions differently.
How long were you with them?
For 2 years.
Wow. And of course, I mean, Amazon is one of those companies that, much like Apple and Google and Microsoft, everyone knows because it's touched their lives in some way or another, whether they know it or not, whether it's through cloud computing services or if you've bought a Christmas present for a loved one, right? And what I find very fascinating about Amazon as a company is I find it impossible to wrap my brain around the way they do the things they do, the way they get that product to me from halfway across the world while dealing with, you know, 100 million other orders at the same time. I mean, just talk to me about, I guess, the logistical insanity that is Amazon.com.
So Amazon actually, if you really look at it, is many companies. So you, of course, know the customer-facing view.
Correct.
But Amazon Web Services has become the internet backbone, essentially, that even I hear the CIA is running on Amazon Web Services. So there are many aspects to it. And the one unifying aspect is, of course, Jeff Bezos and his view on being the most customer-centric company in the world. And that customer can be you as an individual. It can be the CTO of a startup, or it can be a multinational or a business which is trying to sell things from Malaysia into the United States.
And of course, all of this stuff that Amazon does is driven by data, consumer data, CIA data, all kinds of data. So tell me this, if I were to collect somehow every piece of data that there was to collect about me, how big would that be? How many folders would that fill?
So it is difficult to really quantify data. Of course, we all know megabytes and gigabytes and terabytes, but that isn't really it. So let's take a picture. We know a picture is worth 1,000 words, so that's one way of characterizing a picture. But more importantly, think about how the resolution of pictures has dramatically increased over the last years.
Yes.
So now, if I look at how many bits do I create in pictures, I get an almost exponentially increasing number. Versus if I look at how many pictures do I take now compared to 5 years ago, it probably didn't change much. So the question is, what is the unit of analysis? How do you measure things? Now, Albert Einstein, the famous physicist, once said, not everything that can be counted counts. And not everything that counts can be counted. So there really is an element of almost wisdom of knowing what good metrics are. How can we describe the happiness, the delight of the customer, given what we can observe about them without being intrusive?
And metrics and methods of calculation become increasingly complicated when it comes to something like social data, for example, and exactly what you talk about in your book as well. I mean, the enormous amount of information that can be collected from just one day of activity, of the things that I may do in just one day. How do you quantify that, and how do you even measure that? Because there doesn't seem to be a uniform standard of measurement.
Yeah. So it's crazy, the amount of different data we collect in a day, starting in the morning when we wake up, and we probably, most of us, first grab our phone before we even talk to, you know, whoever else
Correct.
Might be in bed with us. And that means that the telephone company, they know when you wake up. But so does, if you use Gmail, so does Google. And they know what captures your attention, which links you might be clicking on in the news. And then finally, when you do get up, I live in San Francisco and I have a smart meter. Now, I just made myself an espresso here. That signature in San Francisco gets picked up by the electricity company. And not only do they know that I made myself an espresso, they know whether it was a single or a double one.
So that, for me, at first glance, is an incredibly scary proposition. And I think for a lot of people, it is, right? There is this sense of fear about data. And I have a feeling it's rooted in a certain sense of ignorance about data as well. So talk to me about, I guess, the fear and apprehension that people have about corporations, the electricity company, about Google, about Apple, about Amazon, about all these people getting their hands on my data.
It very much depends on where you are. In Europe, where I was born, the fear really is that companies might want to manipulate you to buy more. And that is really evil. Wow. In America, what else would we want Amazon to do but to sell us stuff, whether we know it or not?
Embrace the capitalism.
But government, like early this year, Amazon Alexa data got subpoenaed. So a court forced Amazon to hand over the recordings people had made in their home. So the fear there is much more fear of the government. And if you think about it, and maybe that shows how Americanized I've become, you know, what's the worst thing that Google can do to me? They can delete my emails. They can lose my YouTube channel, as they have. There went my belief in Google having backups. And what's the worst thing the government can do? They can put me in prison, as the East German government put my father into prison, believing that he was a spy.
So, Andreas, is it then too much of a stretch for me to believe that, you know, given the scale of these corporations, the Apples and the Googles, and how much information that they have, is it too much of a stretch then to say that they are in many ways arms of the government?
So there was a wonderful article in the Wall Street Journal about 2 weeks ago written by Josh Chin and his colleague Lisa. And it was precisely talking about how in the People's Republic of China, the big companies, Alibaba, Tencent, yeah, Baidu, are the ears and the eyes of the government. And in some cases, it doesn't even need to be big data. It can be very small data. I've heard that the locks in China are centrally manufactured, the locks for hotel rooms, and distributed by the People's Security Bureau, which is the police. And if you just know that a certain room, the door opened 5-10 times in the middle of the night, you don't need big data to know that something interesting might be going on there.
It also means that if it's centrally manufactured, one person has access to all the doors.
Not necessarily. I think that I'm less worried about.
Right.
In a hotel, you know, there always are people who might want to get into your room for whatever reason. It is more the fact that the data is collected, and in most cases, it is innocent people. But then what I worry about is the cases when somebody innocent left patterns that look like they are criminal.
Right, of course.
It might have just been a coincidence. In a country with 1 billion people, of course, there are many coincidences. And then it is very hard to prove that against the government.
Most of us are trying our best to keep our information from getting online. To us, privacy is paramount, but not for Andreas. In fact, the more data there is to share, the better. Uma finds out why that is when we come back. It's the evening edition, BFM 89.9.
Because freedom matters. BFM 89.9.
You're back on the evening edition. I'm Tasha Fusil, and tonight, Uma Pagan Abike Pagan speaks to Andreas Weigand, who is the former chief scientist at Amazon and author of the book Data for the People: How to Make Our Post-Privacy Economy Work for You. And here, Uma picks the conversation back up by finding out about Andreas's pretty unorthodox stand on data privacy.
Andreas, you are a firm believer in putting yourself out there, right? I mean, you are a firm believer in the fact that getting yourself out into the ether, the benefits of which outweighs hiding yourself away and being concerned with privacy. But of course, all of the conversations we have, and I guess in mainstream, all the things we hear about are people going, how do I protect myself?
Good question. Yes. So, for instance, the Data Protection Agency in Germany, which is going to have a new law coming into place in May next year, where anybody's data, European citizens, but also companies that do business with European citizens, really have very strict laws about what it means to protect those data. So I, for example, put out on my website, weigand.com/itinerary, my itinerary. It tells you even what seat I'm going to be sitting on Air Asia on my flight to Bangkok tonight.
A lot of people would say that's crazy.
And I would ask them, why?
I have no answer to that. It just feels like it should be private.
But I have had many examples where good things came out of it.
Right.
For example, I landed in Portland, Oregon one day. And as I was on the jetway, I got a call from somebody who said, you don't know who I am, but I saw that you're landing in Portland and I was wondering if I can give you a ride from the airport to wherever you're going, because that way I can get, you know, half an hour off your time in my car for free. Or the other one, of an airline down under, where I had just made myself comfortable when the appetizer arrived, as my neighbor started talking to me and said, well, hello, I work for this company and I saw you on this flight. And I figured, I have your undivided attention for next 8 hours. So I booked this ticket and I have a few questions about customer data for you. That I thought was a bit impressive. And I told him, he has all my time during the appetizer. But once the main course arrives, I want to have my peace.
When did you come to this realization? When did you think it was okay to put yourself out there?
So I do remember very distinctly that in 1994, I visited Peking University in China and gave a few lectures. And I, at that stage, very much already, there was no web at the time, by the way, but very much already had the attitude, if somebody wants to know where I am, they should be able to find it out. And the way we did it those days was in Unix. There's a .plan file. And I would write down, you know, where I am in my .plan. And anybody in the world could say, finger, aweigand@stanford.edu, et voila, here comes up the little text I put there. So I was always updating that. So I was there in mainland China in 94. And I said, you know, not what's Wi-Fi, but, you know, where's a computer which is connected to the internet? And they look at me saying, computer, connect to the internet? And they came back half an hour later and said, we got a bicycle for you. And we biked for probably an hour in December in Beijing, cold. And then we arrived somewhere at the Academy of Sciences. And I thought that was a lot of hassle to find a computer that was connected to the internet. About 10 years later, I learned that that was the first computer
Wow.
That was connected to internet. So I happened to be there at week one. And that request was, you know, so random to people, but they solved it. And I updated my .plan file. So that was 94. That was quite a number of years ago, 25 years ago roughly, for which I have done that.
So tell me this though, then why, what are we afraid of? And when you've spoken to people and they've told you, hey, you keep doing this, it's kind of crazy, and you ask them, why not? I mean, what do people tell you they're afraid of? Is it safety, security? Is it a false sense of privacy?
Well, we are afraid of people learning things about us through the data we create that we don't want them to know. We discussed whether the gap between your online personality and your offline personality is getting bigger or is shrinking. I personally think it's shrinking because it's just too much work to keep up.
To keep curating
about
the exactly. most perfect image of yourself.
Yeah.
Should we resign ourselves to the fact that we're living in a post-privacy world?
Absolutely. So, and that's not
that
new.
Is not the answer a lot of people want to hear.
No, but I would say not only a post-privacy world, but really a post-privacy economy. And that also is the subtitle of my book, Data for the People. And it's important that there is this economic aspect. What is the value of your data? And for me, the value of data is the effect that data has on a decision. So back to the example of me publishing which seat I'm going to be sitting on. If somebody can base a decision on that. For example, I just talked to people at Fast Retailing, Uniqlo in Japan, and they said, we see on your website that you are in China until Lunar New Year, until Spring Festival. And that was wondering whether you just hop over to Tokyo for a couple of days to meet with our CEO while you are still in Asia. So for me, who actually subscribes to the notion that one of the important advances of the internet, of the web for us, is to increase efficiency. It means that no 5 phone calls and emails between my assistant and their assistant are needed. Here's my schedule. Let me know what you think. Figure it out internally, and then I'll add it to it. And in case I make a mistake, you will be able to catch it.
So who then in this situation has the control and the power? Is it the individual or is it the corporations that have so much data from so many people?
So in this specific example, I'm the one who puts things up on Viking.com. So there
so you have the control.
Ambiguity about that. Last but not least, that I want to avoid mistakes. Or if they're mistakes, then I want to be responsible for them and I will be able to fix them. In the bigger picture, how has the balance of power shifted in this triangle between individuals, corporations, and government? And it's complex. I deeply believe in transparency. So both when I work with companies where I think transparency is important, that they show their consumers transparently what they do with the data, that people can make a decision of whether they want to do their business with this company or that company based on how their data is being treated by the company. But also the transparency between individuals. Now, I can say I request the government to share with me the data they have. That's a law in Germany. That's a law in the United States. I don't know about the situation here in Malaysia. But you can't have the same request to an individual. I can't say, and now I want to see all the notes you have about me. So there are some asymmetries between individuals and companies and government. But in general, it's unclear to me, what do we need to do that the balance of power tips more towards an empowering of the individual?
And is that the way forward? So that all of us will have complete access to all of our data. Because data is money and data is power. And I guess that's why corporations and individuals want to hold on to this commodity.
It is tricky. The value of data is the decisions this data impacts. It's not necessarily a monetary value. So I agree that, you know, Google, by helping people make better decisions, slightly influenced by companies advertising there, by the ads they show, Facebook less subtly than Google, so that those companies make money off my data. But what is my data? So I talked about my data and gave an example of phone call, where they at least have the metadata that I called you. So is this my data that I called you? It's also your data. It's our data. So many of the properties that we know from the physical world, like ownership, do not straightforwardly apply to the digital world. And I, a couple of years ago, visited a fellow countryman in New Zealand, Kim.com, who has billions of dollars of fines against him violating copyright. And I think these are ridiculously old models of how the industrial military movie complex tries to resist change. The music industry has moved on. I happily pay every month 20 bucks to Spotify or whatever my favorite music subscription service is to have, and that is amazing. All of the world's music.
Everything.
At my fingertips, wherever I am.
When we come back, Andra speaks to Uma about what it means to be data literate. It's the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Break from monotony. BFM 89.9.
It's the Evening Edition. I'm Tasha Fusil. We've been speaking about how to live in what our guest tonight calls a post-privacy era. Anders Weigand, former chief scientist at Amazon and author of the book Data for the People, How to Make Our Post-Privacy Economy Work for You, was recently in the studios with Uma Pagan and PK Pagan, and they spoke about how to take control of our data privacy. Now, Andra says that we are heading into the kind of future where we will have rights and access to all our personal data. But he doesn't believe that there's much that we can do to change or manipulate all that information.
How much control do we then have over our own data? How much are we allowed, or can we manipulate it, change it?
Not much. I think the question is not really about controlling or manipulating our data. The question is, how can we become more data literate? Which means, how can we understand what happens with our data? How can we understand how our data get combined with other people's data to help us make better decisions?
So how then, Andreas, do people become more data literate? Because at the moment, we are passive consumers of everything. Of Instagram, of Facebook, of Twitter, of Amazon, of all of the things that kind of take our data and use our data, if our smartphones, we just have the device. We are no more than drivers getting from point A to point B.
Or being driven.
Or being driven.
Maybe not even knowing where the journey is taking us. That is the more likely case. So if you take a step back in history and think what literacy meant in the Middle Ages. It meant that people could follow passages read in church, that they could follow these passages in the Bible, that they could recognize where we are right now, when they have to stand up and when they have to knee. For all of us, literacy is that we can turn text into meaning. What I want is that we learn to turn numbers into meaning. And that is a skill which needs to be taught and learned, just like reading and writing was learned. And maybe, and I just had a discussion last week with Daniel Kahneman in New York over dinner, maybe it is actually more important. So I made the point to Danny that who cares whether you can spell correctly? The computer knows how to fix my spelling. But I care for asking the right questions about numbers. And then he said, no, typically, if you spell correctly, it also indicates a clarity of thought, that it's not just the surface nature of the spelling, but it's also more of a deep nature of thinking more slowly.
Yes. And you know, I think that's absolutely important as well, because it shows that you've kind of trained your mind in a certain way. But that being said, I mean, the idea of teaching data literacy, is anyone on board with that yet?
Oh, totally. I think, for example, tomorrow I'll be at Siam Cement, and I will start off my presentation by telling them that in less than a decade, it will cost less to analyze the DNA when you're using the bathroom than to flush the toilet.
That's a frightening thought. Do we all need to learn how to code?
Well, do you need how to build a car if you want to drive safely? No. But you have to have a mental model of kind of how the engine works. And so I think, well, if you know how to code, great. It's very empowering to know how to code. But data literacy is different from knowing how to code. So to answer your question, I think, yes, it is awesome for people. And I can only encourage them to take a class in learning how powerful it is to code simple things, to use code other people have created, and just to modify it, and to see that you can write a crawler which is going out, following links on the internet, and bringing results back to you. So very powerful experience. But we don't need this to be data literate. Data literacy for me also means to understand what logical consequences are. That, let's say, if I get into a cab and the taxi driver asks me, where would you like to go? And I say, that is none of your business. That's my privacy. That trip isn't going very far. So many people have that same naive notion that, well, you know, I really don't want Amazon or the phone company to know exactly where I am. But then when I deliver pizza, then I want that pizza to show up at my doorstep, not at my neighbor's doorstep. So those are examples, you know, simplified examples, of course, that people sort of intuit that you need to enter the address you want to go to into the navigator, and you have to give it access to where you are. Otherwise, it cannot tell you what the best route is.
Andreas, you are someone who is incredibly positive about, I guess, the benefits of data, but surely there are sinister people out there as well who can use this data for nefarious purposes. And by putting ourselves out there, are we not removing one layer of protection? Should we not be more careful?
So are we more protected when people know where we are? Or are we less protected? Would an awful historic situation like Hitler have been more awful if they had today's databases? Or would the resistance, the people who managed to rebel against it, many of them paying with their lives, would they have been more effective?
One last thing before I let you go. In your, I guess, looks into the future, as I'm sure you'll want to do, what do you think, or where do you think the world is in 5 years, in 10 years, are we on the right track with regards to the way we approach data and its utility?
So I think we're at a very historically interesting situation, if you will, at a fork in the road. Data of the people and by the people. Will they be data used against the people? Let's say insurance companies not insuring you if you have pre-existing conditions, or if they don't like what the 23andMe DNA analysis showed them? Or will we be able to be more inclusive and use the data of the people, by the people, to become data for the people? I deeply hope that through data literacy, education, that we manage to create more fairness. But ultimately, I think back to Plato with the allegory of the cave, of the few prisoners who were chained from birth and could only look straightforwardly onto the wall, not the Facebook wall, onto the cave's wall. And they made sense out of their world, or the world how they perceived it, of shadows moving on that wall. Well, our world is not that different, because we only see the world according to Google. If Google doesn't give you an answer, the thing doesn't exist. And I personally think that while it's important for us to become data literate, it is even more important for us to convince governments to regulate appropriately those who control what we see on our wall. What is the objective function of a Facebook for showing me ads that I'm really not interested in? I actually managed to complain bitterly enough to a friend of mine who works at Facebook and succeeded of being in that control group, in that group of people who do not see ads. And my life clearly is happier to not be bothered by things I don't want to see. I know I could have taken a Facebook vacation and I was close to that, but that was the smooth alternative.
You lucky, lucky man.
Indeed.
Andreas, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you.
Pleasure was mine. Thank you.
That was Andreas Weigand speaking to Uma Pagan Abike Pagan about data privacy and how he thinks we can embrace life in this post-privacy era. If you've missed any part of this program, head to our website, www.bfm.my, or our mobile app to download the podcast. I'm Tasha Fasil. This has been the Evening Edition on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.